Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 3rd of April 2016. My name's TRP Watson. This week I'm joined by Gareth James, Julie Raby and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Les Blancs by Lorraine Hansberry. This is a play first premiered in 1970 and actually put together about 5 years after Lorraine Hansberry herself died. Lorraine Hansberry, of course, is most famous for the play Raisin in the Sun, which is the first play, I believe, by a black woman ever to be put on Broadway, and it took quite a long time, I think, until the next one happened. The play is partially about a black intellectual called Ishembe, who has been living in Europe, indeed has a wife. He returns to Africa to see his sick father, but actually arrives only in time for the funeral. His father was a tribal leader and part of a resistance movement against colonial rule. We are in the 1960s here, and it is the death throes of the various European empires in Africa. We're not given a specific place, but given some of the names, seem to be often a mixture of Dutch-sounding names and English-sounding names, the names of the white characters, that is. We may be looking at somewhere that has echoes of Kenya and South Africa, that sort of place, and not so much the more francophone places like the Congo or Rwanda or Burundi. But I think Lorraine Hansberry was sort of taking all of them, and all of the chaos we had and the potential repression by colonial people. I mean, the big colonial places you tend to think of in Africa, certainly from the British Empire point of view, are places like South Africa, like Zimbabwe and Kenya. We don't think of the other places that were part of the British Empire of having large white settlement. I mean, Kenya was a place of very large white settlement, which went over rather violently. We have things like the Mau Mau in Kenya, who fought back bloodily against British rule and were repressed equally bloodily. And so it's probably lessons like that that Lorraine Hansberry is getting. This particular production is directed by Yael Farber, who directed a very, well, I'll say important, but that's not quite the word I mean, version of Miss Julie, set in South Africa, named Mees Julie instead. She also directed a version of The Crucible a year or so ago to great acclaim. And she has assembled a rather impressive cast here, I think. We have Elliot Cowan, Anna Madley, Sean Phillips, Danny Sapani, Gary Beadle, James Fleet, Clive Francis, among others. Gareth, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
The first thing I think that sort of grabs me is, why on earth has it taken us so long to see this play? Because I think it's a 20th century American classic, to be frank. I mean, it's up there along with, you know, plays by Miller and Tennessee Williams and Eugene O'Neill as a great American play. Although the other part of me is saying I'm really glad it waited for Yael Farber, because the production is so good that I'm kind of glad that its first production in the UK is such an extraordinary one, really. As you say, it was written by her in her early 30s. She died of cancer when she was 34. And she only wrote three plays. This was the third unfinished of three plays. And one just wonders, you know, had she had a longer life, how much she would have contributed to theatre. I mean, because I think on the basis of Raisin in the Sun and this, she clearly was a very special playwright indeed. I think the other thing to say about it is it kind of centres on two places. It centres on a mission hospital, which has been set up actually by Scandinavian missionaries. And then the village that it's in or nearby, and in particular the Matozi family that Chembe is one of the three brothers of. And he does have two other brothers, and I think it's important. One of them has just about to become a priest, so he's kind of followed the line of following the missionaries. And another is actually mixed race, and we do eventually find out who his father was. And he's very damaged as a result of that and the impact of that in the sort of community he lives in. And their mother was actually incredibly good friends with the missionary wife, as it were. The part was played by Sean Phillips. So what you've got is you've got the missionaries and the mission hospital, where you have a couple of European doctors. Then you have the colonial power represented by this just one character, Major Rice. And then you have local people who have different attitudes to both the missionaries and indeed to the colonial power. And the play manages to sort of look at the situation from all angles, really. And then what it does very cleverly is it draws parallels with civil rights in the US at the time, because this is set in the early 60s. So that was, you know, the key point of the civil rights movement in the US, and segregation was still in existence. And of course, countries like Kenya weren't independent until the early 60s. So we are, you know, this is a very real colonial situation. It's only kind of 40 years ago, which is just astonishing when you think about it. And they draw these parallels because there's a character, a journalist called Morris, who's played by Elliot Cowan, who's visiting the missionary hospital on some sort of research trip and is taking photographs and talking to people. And this Chwembe, who is back from Europe, and he's been in Europe, kind of lobbying, I guess, for independence, and a kind of exiled leader in waiting. And he have been sort of going to around Europe and America as part of that process. And they have these debates between Morris and Chwembe, which are frankly electrifying, and largely because the acting of Elliot Cowan and Danny Sapani is just fabulous. And it just, I mean, they are just some of the greatest parts of this play, really. So it's commenting on colonialism, but not in a kind of heavy-handed way. And it's looking at these different attitudes of indigenous people. And indeed, it's looking at motivations as well. It's looking at the motivations of the settlers, and looking in particular the motivations of the missionaries and the medical staff, and kind of questioning how much are they doing this for themselves as much as they're doing it to help other people. But of course, when there is an uprising, which there is, then you have the attitudes of the colonial power, which is quite vicious, and then you have the attitudes of the missionaries and the settlers when they're on the receiving end, because they're in the front line, they're effectively on the receiving end of the revolutionary rage and the revolutionary anger. So however benevolent and defenseless they are, they actually kind of get drawn into it, really. I just think it's a really, really good play, and the production is just stunning. I mean, it's hard to imagine it getting a better production. I mean, Yael Farber uses the Olivier stage just wonderfully. It's just kind of epic kind of staging. And they use the revolt. So there's just a kind of impressionistic missionary building in the middle. And then the village is just played out in front of that on the earth, as it were. And the stage is covered with sand or earth. And the revolve takes you to different parts of the mission building. And there's incredible lights, which gives you a real kind of feeling that you're in Africa. Tim Lutkin's lighting really is extraordinary. And I thought Sutra Gilmore's design was a kind of a model of restraint, really. I think just incredibly effective, but actually probably because it isn't over cluttered and isn't a big kind of design. It's a very simple kind of design, really. There is a kind of soundscape by Adam Cork and music. And then we have a quartet of what they call African matriarchs, who are actually singing one or chanting and singing these wonderful, wonderful ethnic songs, which give it an extraordinary atmosphere. And there's this omnipresent woman, this sort of semi-naked woman who's kind of stalking all the time. And I thought perhaps, you know, was representing Mother Africa or something, but she sort of also brings this incredible atmosphere to it. So I just thought it was a great, great staging. And the performances, you know, as you say, she's assembled a fantastic cast, but she's also got stunning performances out of that cast. In addition to Sapani and Cowan, who I thought were just superb. I mean, Sean Phillips, you know, I mean, what wonderful work is she doing at this point of her career? I mean, she's in her 80s, and she gives a performance here of just incredible dignity as this blind missionary's wife from Scandinavia who's now kind of living in Africa and has Africa going through her blood. I thought it was just a stunning performance. And then Clive Francis, who bears the weight of being the colonial power on stage, really. And he just kind of sends a shiver up his spine with some of the things he's doing and saying. And I thought that was just a brilliant characterization, you know, of someone who kind of sets your teeth on edge, really. Gary Beadle, someone I've seen before, but never doing something as good as he does as the brother Abiose. And then a young actor called Tunji Kasim, who just beautifully captures the complexity of this other brother, Eric, who's his mother, and then is kind of living with this extraordinarily complex kind of parentage, really. I mean, we knew that, or I knew that Mies Julie, you know, was very special. I thought this is a director to watch here. And then when she did The Crucible, I mean, a definitive Crucible for me. And here we are, I think, probably the best of them all. I mean, I just would like, I'd like them to take her passport away and make her continue working here forever, really, because I think Yael Farber is very, very special as a director indeed. And I found the whole thing just enthralling and captivating and just very moving. And I led the standing ovation on what was the last preview. She seems to have done a lot of work on the play during preview, though, because the program says 3.5 hours. The website, the day I went, said 3.25 hours. But on the last preview, which I'm assuming was the same, it came in at 2 hours and 50 minutes. So I suspect they've done a lot of cutting. She does have a tendency to create atmosphere through a lot of unwritten, unspoken stage business, as it were, which is what she did in The Crucible, where she increased the length of The Crucible by creating this work that gives you the atmosphere, really. But she seems to have cut it in preview here, or some of it in preview here. So, I mean, one of the best things I've ever seen on the Olivier stage, one of the best things happening in London at the moment, and absolutely to be recommended for me.
Yeah, I managed to see this 1.5 times because I saw the first preview, which got called off at the interval because the Revolve broke down. I mean, the problem with having this impressionistic mission, as you put it, is that we sat there thinking, why are they making so much fuss about this rather skeletal building that they're not really using because most of the acting is taking place in front of it? And there was actually quite a lot of barracking when they called the play off, because obviously people were enjoying the play and were intrigued by it and wanted to see it all the way through. And they got denied it because something which they saw as unnecessary was stopping them watching it. I kind of agreed with them. I mean, the argument from the National Theatre, of course, was that the artistic vision is using this mission building and it's got to be there and it's got to rotate. And in some ways it rotates to show different aspects of the building, either to tell you whether you're inside and outside the building or to let you know that you're somewhere else. For example, you know, when you're in the village with Chembe's family, the set revolves to show a certain aspect which can be interpreted as part of the village. And you sort of felt, when I watched it the half time I saw it first, it really wasn't all that necessary. I think, having seen it after the previews, after the first night again, watching it through, I did actually find myself counting. It took 5 minutes on the night I actually bothered to count, about 5 minutes, until the first scene is made. They sort of wander around the stage a lot. The most of the other transitions only took about a minute, which isn't too bad, but I'm fairly sure when I saw it on the first preview, that initial part, it felt like 20 minutes of people just wandering around the set, and this girl, played by Sheila Atim, who I think is more of a model stroke actress, but does quite a lot of modelling, and you can see that that figure that she has is very imposing and impressive and a little bit too thin, I think. And I think that that's what Yael Farber wants to have, this character. She is one of the characters that Lorraine Hansberry wrote, the idea of the woman, and she was supposed to be the only black woman you see. And of course, Yael Farber has populated. We have a fairly large ensemble here, and there's a character who is playing one of the house servants, is written as a man, but is being played by a woman. And of course, you have these matriarchs. I think the matriarchs are a sort of a group, plus a musical director who has come in with this sort of old trio from the francophone parts of Africa rather than the anglophone parts, if that makes any sense and is not intensely racist. So she's obviously cut down, you know, all the gaps and all that business, which was just vexing. You wanted them always to get on with the play, and when they get on with the play, it is very impressive. And there are certain things you notice, because although they handle things, Dennis Sapani's character talks about the apartheid system in America, the idea of them living these separate lives, and this goes through even to today sometimes. You see, in parts of America, there is a very great difference between African Americans and European Americans. But there's also one thing that doesn't go mentioned. There's an awful lot of mentions of sort of 300 years in here. And 300 years is significant in the 1960s, because that 300 years would take you back to the 1600s, the 17th century, actually when the Crucible, oddly, is set. And if you've been there in Africa that time, that's the same time the Americans have been in America, certainly the America as it is today, because of course the Spanish parts of America were colonized a couple of hundred years before that. But what goes unmentioned, of course, is the American Indians, the Native Americans, who were displaced and their land was taken away in exactly the same way that was happening to Africa. And to me, it didn't get mentioned. And if I thought that since she was giving every character a slightly different attitude to colonialization and to what you need to do about Africa, I would have liked to have seen that bit mentioned as well. I mean, perhaps she didn't want to be nasty about America in this play, or it didn't occur to her, because maybe it wasn't an issue in 1965, but by the time you get to the 70s, you get a lot more interest in the Native Americans, in the American Indians, and their plight, and the fact that they've been left behind, and their history has been sort of taken away in a much more comprehensive way than happened in Africa. So that was an interesting thing left out. But we do get a lot of these arguments within the play about things like, I think of it as the difference between the pioneers and the colonists. And the pioneers come in and they want to live like the locals. If people have goats running around and goat dung, that's how they're going to live. And then you have the other people who are more the colonists, the settlers, who come in and say, well, no, actually, we want it to remind us of home. And you see it even now in holidaymakers. You know, you have the kind of holidaymakers who will go and live in a hut and think themselves wonderful, and the other kind of holidaymakers who will go to a country and say, okay, how do I plug this television in, and how do I get Coronation Street? And there is that, those two kinds of attitudes, and each attitude has its positives and negatives. I mean, the problem with the pioneers that we see, and the problem with some of the attitudes that we see within this play, the pioneers sort of say that they are respecting the locals, but at the same time, they're sort of being paternalistic, and that's one of the failings of one of the offstage characters we get here. And it's very interesting that we have this offstage character. We're always waiting, expecting him to suddenly turn up, because he's constantly mentioned in the first half of the play. And his attitude, this pioneer attitude, it's kind of paternalistic. It treats the locals as children, and you get this picture, perhaps, of a young person patting the old man on the head and calling him my boy or something, or my child, which is intensely patronizing. And then the other part, which is the settler part, the settlers want to make the country their own and in their own image, and want to import modern European medicine. And that, in some ways, is actually how the locals would like to be. The locals want the best of both worlds, really. They want their traditional society, but also, actually, given the opportunities, they would rather like the modern hospitals and the modern healthcare and nice roads and everything. So denying them that because they're children is wrong, but insisting that they have to be like that is also wrong, because it denies their history. And that sort of pull from the white point of view between the attitude of the settlers and the pioneers is there, but it's also, you know, how about also asking the Africans what they want? And I think that that's also brought up here. So it brings up an awful lot of issues and situations that you can think about, and is also, as you say, a very good play. I mean, it's very good. I was especially impressed by Sean Phillips. I mean, obviously, Dennis Tapani and Elliot Cowan are very good, but Sean Phillips reminding me that she looks better now than the makeup of her when she was playing Livia in the late 70s in I, Claudius, and they made her up to be this age. Well, she looks a lot better now than they made her up to be, so that's interesting. But she is always a fascinating presence when she's on stage. The only person I think was slightly underused was Anna Madeley, who of course was in the Crucible and is possibly a favourite actor of Yael Farber, which is a good thing, because I definitely want to see the next thing Yael Farber does, and I always like to see Anna Madeley on stage. But I thought her character was a little bit underwritten and a little bit underused, and she was just somebody there to put a point of view. And I think that one or two of the characters felt like that. They were there, you know, simply in order to have a point of view and not really be fully realised characters. But I think that was only a slight quibble on what is otherwise a very, very good play. So what do you think about Lebranc's, Julie?
I think I agree with both you and Gareth on that. I did think it was an excellent production, and I also saw it in previews, and I thought it played around with some really interesting ideas, and it certainly made me think afterwards. I went on the Saturday night, and it had been advertised as 3.5 hours, but it actually came down after 3 hours, which I was quite pleased about, because it took some concentration. But I did find it kept me gripped all the way through, and there was a standing ovation at the end of the performance that I went to, and I think it was a well-deserved standing ovation. I think I agree that the characters playing the settlers were quite stereotypical, particularly the major, who it turns out kind of embodied the violence of colonialism in his character, but also in terms of other brutalities that come out later. But then that was quite an interesting idea because you did get the different debates. And I quite like the way the set moves slowly and you have this figure walking round, kind of sometimes pulling a pot, sometimes the movement was the actual revolve, but it looked like this figure was walking really slowly. And I wasn't quite sure if that was meant to represent the kind of timelessness of Africa, because certainly I got a real sense of the heat and the space and the place of Africa watching the production. I think some things rankled a little bit. I think the actors playing the African characters constantly being the ones moving props around the stage, I think was slightly frustrating. I didn't think that was necessary. I did really like the musicians. I often turned to watch them, which, you know, you don't always do, but I was just really fascinated by that. But then as the production moved on, I got a sense of it was about home and people trying to find home, whether it was where you were born or where you travelled to. So the two main characters, the Sean Phillips character, she talks about missing her mountains, but clearly home for her was where she'd settled. Yet the character that had come back from Europe and travelling in America, etc., you know, he wasn't quite sure at certain points where his home was. Was it with his wife and his son and the places that he'd visited? So there's a real sense of people being dispersed and finding home in different places. And I really was fascinated by Tunji Kazim's character, Eric, because I've only really seen him doing Shakespeare, Tunji Kazim. And so it was really fascinating to see him move from doing Florizel and Claudio, and there he was playing this character that I kind of moved through different emotions. And that, for me, was really, really interesting. There was moments when I was quite shocked, that moments that made me jump. There was moments that surprised me, moments, you know, of brutality. When one of the servants gets shot, I was really kind of, my stomach was turning at that point, hoping for that character's safety, but it wasn't to be. So yeah, I mean, I'm really, really enjoyed the production, and I'd seen Ma Rainey's Bottom in the matinee. So it had been a really great day at the National when I saw Les Blancs as well.
We're now going to talk about Bug, which is a play by Tracy Letts, first performed actually in London in 1996. And it's now being performed at Found 111, which is the old Central St. Martin's School. And it's being directed by Sean Evans, who also put on The Dazzle, and stars Kate Fleetwood and James Norton, together with Alec Newman, Daisy Lewis and Carl Precop. The play is about a woman who takes up with a strange man. He's some kind of war veteran. He's on the run from somewhere that is initially unspecified. She feels rather attracted to him. She's having to fend off her ex-husband, who is also just out of prison. And she's trying to keep her life together while beginning this relationship with this rather strange man. At first, he seems a bit supportive, but he has a problem with these bugs that he keeps seeing, and he feels that they are infesting his life, and she slowly descends into that with him, I think it's fair to say. Paul, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Thanks. Well, actually, I think the one thing about this production is, apart from the sort of star cast that's been assembled, because you'll recognize both James Norton and Kate Fleetwood, but also the other supporting cast, Alec Newman, Daisy Lewis, and Carl Prekop, were I've also seen on stage and on television at various points. But I think the other thing about this piece is the star itself has to be the venue. While on one level you can look at it, and when you finally do get to the space, it's sort of square. And I had thoughts of the line from the producers about the man that invented theatre in the square, nobody had a good seat. It adds to the intensity. And there's so much atmosphere in this place as well. I found 111 on Charing Cross Road, which was, as you said, the old school. You walk up a flight of stairs, you can't take the lift, but the lift is there and it's kind of decrepit and dusty. And then you walk past a bar and then you suddenly find yourself in what is a motel room. And I sort of did a double take thinking, well, what is actually real? What's from the old school? And actually, what is actually the set? And it takes you a while to actually work out which is which. And then you find that the seats are just basically around a motel bed and a bar fridge and some coffee making facilities. And so wherever you sit, you're going to have a perspective of the action that is very up close, right in your face, and quite confronting at times. And I noticed just this week there's been a succession of stories about people passing out at the drama that's unfolding literally at their feet. I think, as you said, the piece starts out rather conventionally. Well, conventionally is probably a word that you want to say around a middle American situation where this cocktail waitress in Oklahoma, she's trying to avoid her ex-husband. She's trying to get over the fact that her son has disappeared. But then something turns towards the end of the first half. And this is actually what I really enjoyed about Tracy Letts's piece, is because at that moment, it seems almost like it's an afterthought. But then you actually realize this is what is the whole piece is about. And James Norton's character, and he plays the role of Peter, he initially strikes up a friendship with Kate Fleetwood's character, but then they move into something a little bit more intimate. And it's when he gets, after they have sex and he's in bed with her, he then reveals that he's been bitten by a bug. And then everything slowly starts to turn on that whole piece. And actually, it was quite fascinating to see this world that then suddenly turns on its head. What we think is the blossoming of a loving relationship becomes something a lot more darker and sinister. And the performances by James Norton and Kate Fleetwood are incredibly believable as they sort of go from, you know, two lost souls to suddenly feeling like this, being victims of this much broader conspiracy theory. And when sitting there watching it in such close proximity, as they find bugs coming out of their skin and they find themselves trapped into this world that nobody else quite actually understands. At times it's part Grand Guignol, but it's also part thriller, part horror, but also quite a black comedy as well. And so you're never quite sure what should be funny and what should be horrific. So also I thought this was a terrific performance. And I think what adds to it is that sense of the production, the space, the claustrophobia of the space, but also there's some terrific sound effects, which I'm just looking up the name of the sound designer, Edward Lewis, which just adds to this feeling of creepiness. And I mentioned to a few people afterwards, I was like, you know, I've just been watching a play, but I do feel like there's something crawling over me as well. And it just, I think it gets that psychological balance just right and makes it for quite an intense piece. What did you think, Tim?
I was very impressed by its intensity. It's a very strong piece. It did, I mean, there is this thing when it opens, it's a couple in a motel room, and there's so many plays in America which are basically a couple in a motel room.
Yeah, exactly.
It's such a trope. But the way that Tracy Letts sort of eventually subverts this trope into this much more about the conspiracy theories and much more about things. I mean, the one or two things that I got and had to go back and look up, because it's 20 years ago now that this play was entered, and it is topical, it's supposed to be set in there, and I think they do keep the setting to approximately that. I think we do see, you know, a television, there are certain mentions of things, there are no mobile phones or anything like that here. So we are really in the 1990s with this play, and the whole thing, there's no mistake that this is, I think, in Oklahoma City, which is where the Oklahoma City bombing happened, and it's not that long after the bombing that it happened. And we do get this one line where they're saying, you know, you're John Doe number two, and the Oklahoma City bombing was 1995, and John Doe number two is supposed to be the mysterious co-conspirator with the person who carried it out. And I think you lose that idea on some of the sort of the notions and the feelings that are kind of lost, because the topicality of this play has been lost, so you lose some of the references. But I don't think that too much affects the overall feeling of the play. We are still suspicious of what the military might be doing. We are still suspicious of the activities of American security services, although names may have been changed. I mean, we're much more concerned these days about the NSA than we are, say, about the FBI. And certainly there was a lot more fear of the FBI. That was the target of the Oklahoma City bombing. That was the target to a certain extent. Those were the people you fear. You fear the military, you fear the FBI. These days it would be more about the National Security Agency, which has much more come to the fore and been built up as the sort of the secret intelligence fiefdom, the sort of almost the secret police within America.
That's interesting, actually, Tim, because actually when this piece was written, it was about the Timothy McVeigh Oklahoma bombing conspiracies. But sitting there watching it in 2016, what is was at the back of my mind, and I noticed quite a few other critics have commented on that, is in the light of all the Edward Snowden, the WikiLeaks, it's taken on this new perspective that, well, actually, maybe some of this isn't that far-fetched. Whereas back in 20 years ago, it was very much seen as very much the domain of the conspiracy theorists, the crazy people, the ex-war vets who may or may not have been poisoned by sort of Gulf War drugs that they were taken. So actually the play itself takes on this additional significance that perhaps even Tracy Letts didn't anticipate at the time. But I think, notwithstanding, you know, the intentions of the original piece and, you know, how it sits today, it was quite a fascinating couple of hours to sit through. And I would urge anybody to go see it, because it feels like a theatrical event going to this venue anyway. But, you know, with the cast assembled and the way it's been done, I thought it was terrific.
I think it is impossible to get tickets anyway, because I have had at least one person begging me to see if I can find a source of tickets. I don't think you can get tickets for money or anything. It is interesting that...
Queue for returns, then.
Yes. But I'm not quite as in favour of the venue as you are. I do find it a little bit inconvenient. If you don't get there at least half an hour before the production, you then have to put up with a rather labyrinthine queue that goes into a room. This time I followed the end of the queue. The last time I went, I just waited for the queue to unwind and then snuck in. But I followed the end of the queue, and you have to push past people who are going one way through a small doorway and then join the end of a queue which snakes around this other room, which is quite large, before you get all the way up there. That feels... I didn't really enjoy that kind of queuing. I'm quite used to queuing at unreserved seating venues. And then when you get up there, you are on four sides, but there is a pillar in the middle of the stage, and you can't knock the pillar down because the building would fall down. So it's a sort of this structural thing, which means that someone is always going to be blocked if they stand near it close enough to the pillar. You're not going to be able to see them. So it's an odd thing, and they kind of have to make it a feature of the set and just accept it. So it does seem to be a very odd place, but they are getting some very good people in to do these pieces, but they don't feel long enough, a long enough run so that you can get lots of people in. And They can only get, I think it's around about 100 people a night through the plays, and that's really not enough for the number of people who want to see the quality of play that they are obviously putting on. So it's a bit of a shame that. And
maybe what we need is more open-ended runs at these venues. But yeah, it seems like there's plenty of rooms that they could use here. I must say also, I didn't have that experience of having to queue, but I think that was because I was running very late. And so I came in and just had to take whatever seat was available. And while it wasn't the best seat in the house, I still enjoyed where I was sitting. And, you know, I actually, in some respects, I was relieved because I wasn't as close to the action or the bloody action as some others, and by looking at their facial reactions or looking at how they were looking away, I was somewhat relieved that I wasn't. So I guess maybe where you sit or maybe where you don't sit may also affect how you enjoy this piece.
We're now going to talk about reasons to be happy at the Hampstead Theatre. This is a play by Neil LaBute and directed by Michael Attenborough. It is a follow-up to his 2011 play, or the play that was on at the Almeida in 2011, also directed by Michael Attenborough, called Reasons to be Pretty. In fact, this is the second part of an envisaged trilogy where Neil LaBute is going to revisit these four characters that he first visited in Reasons to be Pretty and is now doing in Reasons to be Happy. So presumably the next part of the trilogy, if it's going to be a trilogy, is going to be the reasons to be something else. But oddly enough, though, that Reasons to be Pretty back in 2011 was actually the third part of a, it's very confusing this, the third part of a trilogy of plays, sort of an informal trilogy, which included The Shape of Things and Fat Pig, both of which have been on in the West End. The Shape of Things was on at the Almeida, and Fat Pig was on at the Trafalgar Studios in, I think, 2008, and Shape of Things was in 2001. The ideas for Reasons to be Pretty were that Greg, who is really the main character in this play and was played by Tom Burke, who is also playing the same character in Reasons to be Happy. In Reasons to be Pretty, Greg is overheard admitting that he doesn't find his girlfriend, Steph, a particular beauty. She is devastated and breaks up with him. Meanwhile, Greg's best friend, Kent, is mistreating his very attractive wife, Carly, and is actually being unfaithful to her. That's the general setup. Now, one of the odd things about this is that when Reasons to be Pretty was done in the Almeida in 2011, it caused a change to the actual play, because the person playing Carly was Billy Piper, who at the time was pregnant, and quite noticeably and heavily pregnant. And they actually changed the play slightly to write that in. And now in Reasons to be Happy, which is set some years after Reasons to be Pretty, the character of Carly, who wasn't pregnant originally when they first did the play, actually is now seen to have a child. We don't see the child, but she talks about the child that she had after the time of Reasons to be Pretty. And this happened, I believe, just because they happened to want Billy Piper for the role. Billy Piper happened to be pregnant, and they thought, well, we're going to adjust to that. It wasn't really a major factor in the play, but it did add a certain amount of poignancy, especially as, you know, you saw this woman being mistreated. I mean, not a physical mistreatment, but it is a psychological mistreatment from her husband. I should mention, in Reasons to be Happy, we have these four characters, Carly, Kent, Greg, and Steph. In Reasons to be Pretty, they were played by Billy Piper, Kieran Bew, Tom Burke and Sean Brooke, respectively. There was a slight problem with the idea of somebody as good-looking as Sean Brooke worrying about not being pretty. It was a bit of a disconnect. In this production of Reasons to be Happy, as I said, we still got Tom Burke playing Greg, but this time Carly is played by Robin Addison, Kent is played by Warren Brown, and Steph is played by Lauren O'Neill. The basic setup here is that the Greg, who in the first play was in the night shift at a factory, and Carly was also part of the night shift but working in security, and Greg has gone away to college, got himself a degree, and is now supply teaching. And we really take up the story from there. Julie, Tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, I did, when I went, realise that it was kind of a sequel to another play which I hadn't seen. So I did feel in some ways I was missing out, because actually throughout it I was really thinking, do I really care about these characters and what happens to them? And I kept thinking about it, and I was wondering if part of what was going on was the sense of the ordinariness of what their lives, and nothing much happening except this kind of relationship swapping. There were some humorous moments, particularly at the start, and I was quite interested in the set, the way the set revolved, etc. And it was kind of played in that, in a can, really. But it was for me quite a struggle to kind of get any sense of narrative or a sense of where these relationships were going to go. And it was quite interesting that it was through the night, you know, the lives happened through the night, because one was a security guard and then the guy was teaching. So there was this kind of sense of a cycle going on, that things would constantly be repeating themselves. And I just wondered if it was meant to be that the two women look very similar, if that was meant to be deliberate, that it was again part of this cycle moving from one to another. I thought there were some interesting moments that the two women kind of sat down and sorted everything out, and there was a sense that the men wanted the women to make the decisions for them because they couldn't make up their own minds. But for me, it was a bit disappointing, because I just expected a little bit more. Maybe I was missing something. I don't know what you thought, Tim.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I was not aware when I booked for the tickets and first read about it. I wasn't aware that it was actually a sequel to Reasons to Be Pretty. But once I got into it and recognised that these were the same characters, I started remembering bits and pieces. And certainly the whole setup here, you do get a sense that there's a lot of history behind it that you perhaps should have known about it. Because, of course, having seen the first play in the sequence, I knew all these characters, I knew their relationship already. So when you have this idea of these people coming back together, if you're introduced to it, you're introduced to it halfway through the story, and you don't really get the sense, perhaps, that Greg and Steph have this very strong history. They'd been going out for a considerable amount of time, or I think it was several years, before they break up in Reasons to Be Pretty. And so in Reasons to Be Happy, when they start edging back towards each other, you don't really get the impression that perhaps that there's any history there, because you have to be told that they have history rather than knowing it, having seen them in a previous play. I was interested, though, when I saw it, by these changes and by the way that Reasons to Be Happy would remind me of Reasons to Be Pretty, and the way that some of the characters, I mean, perhaps I thought one or two of the characters had changed, and I did keep wanting to think back to the original play, and that's possibly a problem if you haven't seen the original, and it might make you not appreciate it as much, because I did enjoy this play an awful lot. I thought it was a good deal of fun and very well performed. In fact, I slightly better performed in some ways than the original Almeida production. I mean, it's not to, you know, disparage people, but I felt that certainly Carly and Seth, they felt somehow more realistic and more real. I think that that's probably me living in the moment and not really remembering particularly well about the other characters. And as I said before, you had this character played by Sean Brooke who was worried about her looks. It was such a disjoint in that play that it didn't make any sense. So I think that it may be a situation where you do have to have seen the first play to really like this play. But I do think it's got a lot of quality, and it was fun on the night. But there are very heavy echoes of the original play. In fact, I think that the structure of the plays are fairly similar. So then the way that the scenes work, in the things that you have where people meet, and, you know, they're constantly going back to this main set of the canteen, the restroom, or the rest area. And we've also got the echo that this set, I think it's by a different designer, but it was based on the original design that they used at the Almeida Theatre. So all of those are echoing the old play, which you're not going to get if you just go to this play. But I did think that this play probably does just about stand up on its own. I mean, I think it is a decent play, but I think it is a part two, and you do need to have seen part one, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it feels, from what you're saying, that you really do need to see part one. Because I do think I did miss quite a lot not having seen Reasons to Be Pretty. So, yeah, from what you're saying, it does sound like you'll get more from it because you can make those connections.
Yeah, I have to say, I kind of look forward to seeing, if there is going to be a third part of this, I do look forward to seeing that, especially if they keep at least Tom Burke on for that particular part, and possibly Michael Attenborough as well. And I would like to see all three plays done together, because I think they would, once they do them, or even both these two plays done together, or maybe to have some rehearsed readings of Reasons to Be Pretty with this cast, because I think it would enhance people's enjoyment of this, because, you know, you do seem to have not appreciated it quite as much as I did.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are ayultp.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.